And in addition to that, there's a even longer standing dispute between the Supreme Court and the executive and the legislature, for that matter, over salaries, over compensation of the Supreme Court justices. So when AMLO took office, he voluntarily lowered his salary. And the Constitution, as it stands, states that no public official can make more than the president. So that meant that by default, the Supreme Court justices who have really high compensation packages would have to take a pay cut. They refused to do so against what the Constitution says. So they have been actually in violation of the Constitution for the past 6 years. And the list goes on and on. Last point I would say here is, for example, by
we have 20 seconds.
Okay. The Supreme Court report on this, their own report, half of the people that work in the judiciary have family members in the judiciary, which just speaks to the level of nepotism and, again, formal networks and semi-formal networks of influence that exist there. So that's the context for the push.
We want to thank you for being with us. Edwin Ackerman is sociology professor at Syracuse University, author of Origins of the Mass Parties, Dispossession and the Party Form in Mexico and Bolivia. We'll link to your piece in Jacobin, AMLO's War on Neoliberal Corruption. We'll do an interview in Spanish at democracynow.org and post it at there. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO is hosting the first Friday's Arts Walk on October 4th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. We'll have local artists, vendors, food, drinks, music, station tours, and more. Join us at 20 Southeast 8th Ave in Portland, Oregon for an evening of culture and fun. Hope to see you there.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon nursing home workers could go on strike as their contracts expire. It's the first annual Cultural Week of Action on Race and Democracy. We visit their exhibit in Old Town. And in national news, former President Trump criticizes FEMA's response to Hurricane Helene. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Unionized employees of five Oregon nursing home companies could go on strike as their contracts expired at the end of September. SEIU announced that unionized workers could strike in order to win a better contract. The companies include Avamere, Empress, Volar, Sapphire, and Caldera Care. Their announcement read, quote, SEIU members are prepared to take any actions necessary, including going on strike, to settle their contracts. As negotiations are slow with little progress and contracts set to expire at midnight, union members will notify management of their intent to take public action at work sites statewide. End quote. Short staffing is rampant at nursing homes, both in Oregon and across the country. Nursing home workers say they face high turnover, understaffing, and insufficient wages at their jobs, and they hope to have that addressed in their new contract. The Vanport Mosaic is a Portland nonprofit dedicated to memory activism, and it is one of 14 community organizations across the country hosting events as part of a cultural week of action on race and democracy. KBOO's Carrie Stewart-Lingle reports.
In Old Town Chinatown, a silvery high-rise on 2nd Avenue used to be the corporate headquarters for Northwest Natural Gas. Today, webs of thick black tape cover window cracks like homemade Halloween decorations. The sign on the corner reads, "Retail space available," but inside, on the 6th floor, there's a happy haunting of sorts taking place.
This district had been called many names, Japantown, Chinatown, historical Old Town, and unflatteringly, Skid Row.
Every day this week, Portland residents are gathering to share stories about the city's oldest and most culturally diverse neighborhood.
immigrants from Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Greek, Italian, African, Roma, and Jewish descent.
African Americans, historically, all the way back to the turn of the century, have been welcome at the Chinese restaurants.
They have all the produce and things in jars that dry bugs and all that.
You never worried about walking in and being refused.
In that day, the Roma community were living in their storefronts and very colorful curtains.
Joni Nakayama, Ed Washington, and Roberta May Wong were among those sharing stories on September 28th to kick off the Portland event titled Coming Home, Memory Activism in Historic Old Town.
She was from Ireland. She sold newspapers, but she never removed that raincoat. When she died, they uncovered thousands and thousands of dollars that were inside her raincoat.
Doug Honda's grandfather moved to Portland in 1915. He called the neighborhood Nihonmachi, or Japantown.
It was the only paper in Oregon that was published in Japanese. And he, I think at its peak, had about 25 employees. In that era, you had no other source of information other than radio or newspapers. So the Japanese community was dependent on him for their world news, national news.
Every one of these stories and each and every one of us in this room are tied together in some way or another.
The Coming Home event includes historical exhibits and walking tours, but organizer Shisao Hata made it clear that the focus is on Old Town's future as well as its past.
We need to kind of take the idea away that don't go down to Old Town because it's too dangerous, and we need to fix it.
As we think about development in our areas, we have to be sensitive to what business needs are work to support those transitions when we're trying to build our city, but at the same time, at whose, you know, risk, you know.
We need to address some of the underlying issues, but also address why did it get this way.
There was talk and dreams of a rainbow coalition, and we're still here. We faded a little bit in time, but I think that it's reemerging. And this is an opportunity to share what that could be like.
Coming Home is one of 14 projects selected by Race Forward and Americans for the Arts for their inaugural Cultural Week of Action on Race and Democracy. Other community organizations hosting events this week include Cleveland Votes, the Dallas Parent Coalition, and the Michael Brown Sr. Chosen for Change organization in Ferguson, Missouri. All of the projects are different. Coming Home builds on the memory activism of the Vanport Mosaic, as co-founder and co-director Laura Loforti explained.
Stories are erased, and they are intentionally forgotten, and so we intentionally remember them and celebrate them.
Coming Home concludes with a Unity Circle for Humanity featuring local taiko drummers and folk dancers. The two-hour gathering begins at 11 a.m. October 5th at 220 Northwest 2nd Avenue. More details are online at vanportmosaic.org.
Remembering is an act of resistance. And you now are a memory activist.
Reporting for KABU Community Radio in Portland, I'm Carrie Stewart Lingle.
Former President Donald Trump criticized the Biden administration's response to Hurricane Helene, despite his own track record on not supporting FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. As president, Trump delayed disaster aid for hurricane-devastated Puerto Rico and diverted money from FEMA in order to finance anti-immigration efforts. In addition, Project 2025, backed by Trump supporters, proposes restructuring to FEMA, limiting disaster aid to states. It also says that the National Weather Service, which provides data on hurricanes and other major storms, should, quote, be broken up and downsized, end quote. Trump just claimed, without supporting his statements, that the Biden administration and North Carolina's Democratic governor were, quote, going out of their way to not help people in Republican areas, end quote. Trump advisor Stephen Miller said President Joe Biden failed to evacuate or rescue U.S. citizens, quote, just like you failed in Afghanistan, end quote. In contrast, the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, said officials have rescued and or supported more than 1,400 people in areas impacted by Helene. Jean-Pierre said, quote, it doesn't matter which state it is. It doesn't matter if it's a red state or a blue state. This is their job, to get food there, to get generators there, to save some lives, to rescue people. So we are very proud of the work that they've done, end quote. Biden did approve major disaster declarations for Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina. FEMA and other federal agencies, along with private businesses and nonprofit and faith-based organizations, has responded in at least 7 states, from Florida to Virginia. Vice President Kamala Harris, who is running against Trump in the presidential election, visited FEMA headquarters yesterday. She called the devastation heartbreaking and promised the impacted communities would get, quote, what they need to recover, end quote. FEMA uses its disaster relief fund to coordinate a federal response to major disasters, paying for debris removal and repairs to public infrastructure, while also offering financial assistance for survivors. A temporary spending bill passed and signed into law last week pushed about $20 billion into the fund, also giving FEMA the ability to spend that money more quickly. Lawmakers are expected to return to Washington shortly after the November election to negotiate a full-year spending bill. Experts anticipate some will seek billions of dollars more for the disaster relief fund. A longshore strike poses possible threats to the economy. Former President Trump turns hurricane relief political. Also, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz will take to the stage tonight for the VP debate. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You're better off sitting down and let's get a contract and let's move on with this world. And in today's world, I'll cripple you.
President of the International Longshoremen's Association, Harold Daggett, says not just their industry, but the economy and consumers will pay the price if they go on strike. The union of thousands of port workers on the East Coast and Gulf of Mexico is demanding higher wages and a ban on automated port equipment. Despite a strike's potential impact, President Joe Biden says he won't invoke the Taft-Hartley Act 80-day cooling-off period. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says negotiations with the employers represented by the U.S. Maritime Alliance needs to reach an agreement.
The stakes are very high. The potential for disruption is significant. We've not had an event occur like this in our ports since 1977.
Hurricane Helene left destruction across big parts of Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Former President Donald Trump was in Georgia Monday assessing damage and faulting the Biden-Harris administration's response in that battleground. He said Governor Brian Kemp hadn't been able to reach Biden.
He's been trying to get them, and I'm sure they're going to come through. But he's been calling the president, hasn't been able to get him.
The Republican Kemp said Trump's statement was false and expressed his appreciation for Biden's response.
And he just said, hey, what do you need? And I told him, you know, we got what we need. We'll work through the federal process.
Congress went on recess last week. They're not scheduled back until after Election Day, but Biden says they may have to return to pass supplemental disaster funding. With a month left in the race, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warns of organized efforts to pervert the image of Vice President Kamala Harris. She cites the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, where Clinton was falsely accused of trafficking children out of a Washington pizzeria. She calls Trump's movement a real danger.
The press needs a consistent narrative about the danger that Trump poses.
Former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, a sharp Trump critic, has officially joined the growing list of Republicans who have endorsed Harris and Walz.
I've served with Kamala in the United States Senate. I've also served with Tim in the United States House of Representatives. I know them. I know firsthand of their fine character and their love of country.
Republican J.D. Vance and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz will take to the vice presidential debate stage tonight. The Democratic nominee made reference to a false internet joke about the Ohio senator when trolling him.
I can't wait to debate the guy. That is, if he's willing to get off the couch and show up.
Israeli special forces are conducting attacks on the ground in Lebanon, along with extensive airstrikes. So far, Hezbollah's ally, Iran, has been restrained in its response. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Progressive Radio host and author Tom Hartman about his new book, The Hidden History of the American Dream. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow, we'll see some clouds and peaks of sunshine with a daytime high of 67. Today in history, in 1924, U.S. President Jimmy Carter was born. He turned 100 years old today. He's the first U.S. president to live to 100. He took office as an outsider in Washington and set out to restore a sense of morality to domestic and foreign policy. The quote of the day is from Carter, who said, quote, "War may sometimes be a necessary evil, but no matter how necessary, it is always an evil, never a good. We will not learn how to live together in peace by killing each other's children." An Indian boarding school memorial in Rapid City, South Dakota, opens, honoring the 50 children who died there more than 100 years ago. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Sunday marked the opening of a memorial to the 50 Native American children who died attending the Rapid City boarding school more than 100 years ago. Organizers say the issue is crucial for understanding race relations in the city. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports.
Martin Hart, Cheyenne.
Members of the Shichangu Youth Council read names of the children who died while attending the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. The annual ceremony starts in Sioux Park, located in West Rapid City. Amy Sazu is the executive director of Remembering the Children, the group that puts on the annual event. She says it's a commitment to the children.
Their families didn't forget them, but this community did. This community forgot that at least 50 children died while attending a school here. And that's important. That's the healing. And that's part of, you know, the division or the differences in community members or people not understanding why things are the way they are.
Bessie, Bear Arm Nicholas.
Hundreds walk about a mile from Sioux Park to the memorial site on a parcel of land just west of the boarding school property, where there are unmarked graves. In 2017, a group of researchers identified the 50 children who died while attending the school. Borders of the boarding school stretched from Bacon Park to Canyon Lake. Researchers also discovered a congressional land transfer that moved a large swath of the land along Rapid Creek from tribal control to churches, schools, and the National Guard. Heather Don Thompson was one of the researchers on the project.
Folks didn't even bother to write down their names when they passed away or to let their families know what had happened to them. So by being able to share this history together, we're able to not only honor and remember those children, but also move forward in a really positive way together as a community.
The memorial site is still under development. A sculpture will get installed in the summer of 2025. That will kick off a series of artworks for the memorial site set to get installed during the next decade.
Female child number 2, unknown, age unknown, date of death 1919.
For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Eastern Shoshone Housing Authority received nearly $8 million in federal funds to invest in clean electricity. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more on how it will bring more solar power to the Wind River Reservation.
According to a report from the Department of Energy, more than 16,000 tribal homes across the country were not electrified in 2022. The Tribal Electrification Program aims to change that with green energy. Charles Washakie is the executive director of the Eastern Shoshone Housing Authority. He says there's a real need for more affordable energy infrastructure for homes.
We have a lot of people out there off the grid. We have like 8 or 9 families off the grid. And then our elders, they're on fixed income and their light bills are going, you know, $300-$400 a month.
The grant was competitive. Washakie says hundreds of tribes applied and only 13 received funding this round. It'll be used to purchase, assemble, and install solar for homes on the Wind River Reservation. I'm Hannah Haberman.
The Onondaga Nation in New York is getting a portion of land back that was taken by the state. Tribal representatives signed legal documents with Honeywell International Friday for the return of 1,000 acres of land, which sits within its original treaty footprint set aside in the 1790s. The transfer is under the federal Superfund program. According to the tribe, this is the first acreage return to stewardship of the nation since New York State and the U.S. government broke a treaty which originally set aside more than 2 million acres. Onondaga Chief Sid Hill says this is a small but important step for them and for the indigenous land back movement across the U.S. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report on agribusiness consolidation says the long period of antitrust inaction from the 1980s onward has resulted in less competition, higher prices, and abusive practices from monopoly actors. Concentration and impacts are examined in agricultural finance, crop insurance, farm machinery, the grain and oilseed sector, along with fruits, vegetables, livestock, poultry, seed, and fertilizer. Brett Pivato reports from Maryland.
A new report looking at agribusiness consolidation finds decades of mergers have reduced competition, leading to higher costs for farmers and consumers in Maryland and nationwide. The report is titled Kings Over the Necessaries of Life and finds a smaller number of large companies are using their market power to dominate nearly all sectors of the food system, from inputs such as seeds and pesticides all the way to grocers. Antitrust attorney Basil Musharbash is the report's author and says the non-enforcement of the nation's anti-monopoly laws since the 1980s has taken a toll.
We found that either a single firm or a small, tightly coordinated group of firms have amassed monopoly power, the power to control prices or exclude competitors from a given market, in nearly every major industry that manufactures and sells farm inputs, that buys or processes farm crops, or that distributes food to the public.
Among other abuses, the report found companies have engineered shortages to keep prices high, as in the egg and fertilizer sectors. Despite rising prices for beef, consolidation has reduced the share of the consumer's dollar going to cattle farmers, which fell from 70% in the 1970s to 30% today. The fertilizer sector has been gradually consolidated over decades, and the report says three large firms are now in control, with one dominating the market for each of the three primary components of fertilizer: nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium. The so-called Big Three are able to control prices in their respective markets, but are also keeping competition out by controlling access to both the raw materials supply and the specialized distributors that sell fertilizer around the country. The report says since the 1990s, the Big Three have raised fertilizer prices, cut output, and reduced the quality and selection of fertilizer available in the U.S. Fertilizer prices increased 60% in 2021 and 132% the next year. Companies attributed the increases to supply chain problems, but Musharbash found their own financial report said otherwise. He says it amounts to extraction from farmers and ultimately consumers.
Because of their power, they've been able to reap Apple-style profits on products that haven't been improved materially since the 1960s. It's that sort of extraction that has been facilitated by the monopolization that we've seen across the agriculture sector.
The report includes an agriculture consolidation data hub where different sectors are outlined. Consolidation and its impacts are tracked in agricultural finance, crop insurance, farm machinery, the grain and oilseed sector, along with fruits, vegetables, livestock, poultry, seed, and fertilizer. The seed industry is now dominated by four large firms and has seen prices rise faster over the past 20 years than any other farm input. Musharbash says the nation needs to continue and expand the recent efforts to enforce antitrust laws.
It doesn't have to be this way. These firms are smart and powerful. They've executed strategies over decades. The U.S. government allowed it because we made policy decisions not to enforce the antitrust laws to the fullest extent. We can take action to fix that.
He says after a period of neglect, the agriculture sector was also highly concentrated by the 1930s. But the report outlines how over a decade, the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department and the FTC brought thousands of cases against cartel actors in the agricultural economy, eventually restoring competitive markets. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
Cutting climate pollution could save tens of thousands of lives, according to one study. New research links cleaner air to significant health benefits. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Breathing in vehicle exhaust, power plant fumes, and other fossil fuel pollution can harm people's lungs and hearts.
Climate change and environmental pollution impacts us gravely.
So Sarju Ganatra, a cardiologist at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Massachusetts, says reducing climate pollution can improve our health. The U.S. is committed to cutting its climate warming emissions to about half of 2005 levels by the end of this decade. Ganatra and his team used computer models to estimate the health benefits of achieving that target. They found that in the year 2050 alone, it could result in almost 1 million avoided asthma attacks, more than 40,000 avoided heart attacks, and more than 30,000 avoided deaths. That's just a snapshot of the projected health benefits for a single year, and the impact over time will be much larger. So Ganatra says that legislation such as the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, which helps the country achieve its climate targets, not only helps limit global warming.
I think it will lead to significant improvement in our own health. Planetary health is not separate from our health. We are integrated. We are one. We are not separate, and we should not see it otherwise.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Israel has invaded Lebanon, and the U.S. is merely expressing concern. As one observer notes, with Hezbollah in disarray, Iran's direct intervention in the conflict is possible, putting the U.S. on Israel's side at a time when a ceasefire is desperately needed. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker. This segment was taped prior to Israel's invasion of South Lebanon yesterday.
Hello, everyone. Israel's planting of explosive material in pagers and walkie-talkies could be the forerunner to an invasion of southern Lebanon and even Iran's intervention on behalf of Hezbollah. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said these explosions are, quote, the beginning of a new era in this war. Israeli fighter jets, which attacked the headquarters of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and killed its longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah, reinforced the message. Israel's chief of staff, visiting troops in the north of Israel, said the current attacks on Lebanon aim to destroy Hezbollah infrastructure and prepare for the possibility of Israeli troops crossing the border. An Israeli government spokesman asked whether Israel's air assault in southern Lebanon amounts to a declaration of war, said, quote, Hezbollah needs to be ejected from Lebanon. Casualty figures keep rising. The death toll after 3 days of Israeli bombardment had passed 600. Lebanese health authorities say that thousands more people have been injured. The UN said 90,000 people had been displaced, on top of more than 200,000 people who had left their homes in southern Lebanon over the past year as Hezbollah and Israel exchanged fire across the border. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that Israel would take whatever action is necessary, quote unquote, to diminish the threat posed by Hezbollah. No opposition leader in Israel is saying otherwise. Netanyahu has rejected a U.S.-France proposal for a 21-day ceasefire, saying the attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon would continue until Israelis living in the north could safely return home. The U.S. position on the evolving war in Lebanon is strikingly similar to its stance on Gaza. Expressions of concern, lots of subtle diplomacy, but no effort at direct intervention to influence Israel's strategy. Thus, U.S. officials say the Biden administration is extremely concerned about the risk of an all-out war between Israel and Lebanon, but hopes to use growing Israeli military pressure on Hezbollah to get a diplomatic deal to return civilians to their homes on both sides of the Israel-Lebanon border. Israeli officials said their increasing attacks against Hezbollah are not intended to lead to war, but are an attempt to reach, quote, de-escalation through escalation. Presumably, that means they hope Hezbollah will stop attacks on Israel rather than face an invasion. But that isn't happening. De-escalation through escalation could be a strategic error of the highest order. More escalation usually leads to more escalation in return and an out-of-control situation. We have disagreements with the Israelis on tactics and how you measure escalation risk, said Biden advisor Brett McGurk last week. It is a very concerning situation. He should say more than that, such as, enough is enough. U.S. officials are scurrying about trying to contain the fighting. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he was working tirelessly with allies to try to shift the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah back to, quote, a diplomatic process that would allow Israelis and Lebanese alike to go back to their homes. President Biden acknowledged that, quote, an all-out war is possible, but added that there's still the opportunity for a resolution contingent on Israel changing, quote, some policies. We're still in play to have a settlement that can fundamentally change the whole region, Biden said in an interview. The Arab world very much wants to have a settlement because they know what it does for them. They're willing to make arrangements with Israel and alliances with Israel if Israel changes some policies, Biden said. He also said he had a strong relationship with Netanyahu, but, quote, I don't agree with his position. There needs to be a two-state solution. Ultimately, it needs to happen. There's a way to do it, and they have a possibility. I'd say that view amounts to whistling in the dark, since the fighting has clearly overtaken the diplomatic process. A two-state solution seems farther away than ever, and the U.S. is contributing to the increasingly dire situation by refusing to hold back, much less embargo, arms shipments to Israel. Saying that Israel needs to change some policies is fantasy. Fact is, Israel is calling the shots, literally. The longer the war goes on and the more it expands, the less influence the U.S. seems to have, as witness Netanyahu's rejection of the U.S.-France ceasefire proposal and the assassination of Nasrallah. And in this election year, Biden is afraid to act against Israel and hurt Kamala's campaign. But U.S. inaction might lead to Iran's direct intervention, with Hezbollah in disarray and Netanyahu seemingly immune to calls for restraint in Lebanon. War with Iran, with the United States on Israel's side, is entirely possible. Is that part of Netanyahu's game plan? I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Zachary Jones-Nuray, Josh Salem, and Carrie Stewart-Lingle. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Brett Pivoteau, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs